Welcome back to Office Hours. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. We're on lesson six today, Human Development and the Life Course. And I want to open with the framing from the module because it's a big conceptual reframe.
Go.
Until roughly the 1980s, mainstream epidemiology largely treated health risks as if they operated at the time of exposure. A person at 50 with cardiovascular disease was studied for their current diet, current smoking, current activity. Life course epidemiology rejected that snapshot framing. It treats current health as the cumulative result of exposures, opportunities, and choices reaching back to and before birth.
And what made the shift happen?
A small number of foundational studies that demonstrated effects no snapshot model could explain. David Barker's observation that areas of England with high infant mortality in 1910 had high adult cardiovascular mortality 60 years later. The Dutch hunger winter cohort showing in utero famine exposure produced adult metabolic disease. The ACE study showing childhood adversity produced an extraordinary range of adult health outcomes. Each of those forced the field to take time seriously as a variable.
Four sections. The life course frame itself, then DOHAD, developmental origins of health and disease, then ACEs and childhood adversity, and then healthy aging and CLSA.
Connecting points to earlier lessons, the British birth cohorts we'll discuss were on last lesson's list of standing studies. The chronic disease framing we built up over lessons four and five is what life course epidemiology adds another dimension to.
Okay, section one, the life course models.
Three of them, and they're worth keeping separate, even though most life course research combines them. The cumulative model views risk as additive over time. Each exposure adds to a total risk burden. Cumulative models fit conditions like cardiovascular disease and many cancers, where lifetime exposure to a risk factor, smoking pack years, lifetime cholesterol years, predicts outcome better than any single point in time measurement.
Sensitive period.
The sensitive period model argues that certain developmental windows are uniquely consequential. What happens in utero, in early childhood, or in adolescence matters more than equivalent exposures at other times. The Barker hypothesis is the canonical sensitive period model. The ACE study is another. Sensitive period models fit conditions where developmental programming has long-term consequences.
And trajectory.
The trajectory model emphasizes that lives unfold along paths that are launched early and reinforced over time. Early life socioeconomic disadvantage predicts educational attainment, which predicts adult occupation, which predicts adult income, which predicts adult health. Trajectory models fit conditions where the same exposure, early disadvantage, operates through multiple cumulative mechanisms over decades.
And these aren't mutually exclusive.
Right. Most life course research uses combinations. A sensitive period launches a trajectory whose cumulative consequences manifest as chronic disease in adulthood. The intellectual move that life course epidemiology brings, relative to snapshot epidemiology, is the willingness to treat time as a variable, not as a fixed background.
And the foundational birth cohorts that demonstrated this come from the UK.
The 1946 birth cohort, officially the National Survey of Health and Development, launched by James Douglas and continued by Michael Wadsworth and Diana Koo, recruited 5,362 babies born in 1 week of March 1946, followed continuously ever since, major data collections at most life stages. Then the 1958 cohort recruited about 17,000 babies born in 1 week of March 1958. The 1970 cohort, the Millennium Cohort Study from 2000 to 2002. Together, those cohorts span seven decades and provide the closest thing public health has to a longitudinal record of how childhood circumstances translate into adult outcomes.
And the findings have been foundational?
Childhood social class predicts adult mortality after controlling for adult social class. Birth weight predicts adult metabolic and cardiovascular outcomes. Childhood cognitive ability predicts adult mortality through pathways including occupational selection, health behaviors, direct effects on diagnosis and management. Even hand grip strength in childhood predicts later life function. The British birth cohorts collectively have produced more than 6,000 peer-reviewed publications.
And Canada doesn't have something comparable.
Canada's analogous studies are smaller but important. The National Longitudinal Survey of Children and Youth ran from 1994 to 2010 and provided substantial life course data on Canadian children. The CLSA, which we'll get to in Section 4, follows aging Canadians. Quebec's longitudinal studies, particularly the Quebec Longitudinal Study of Child Development, have been productive at the provincial level. But the infrastructure for population-wide birth cohorts comparable to the British ones doesn't currently exist in Canada, a gap the Canadian public health research community has been advocating to address.
And the political consequence of life course thinking is huge.
If chronic disease in adulthood is partly produced by childhood circumstances, then chronic disease prevention requires investment in childhood circumstances, including those of children who haven't yet had any chronic disease. The economic returns to early childhood investment, as documented by the economist James Heckman, are extraordinarily high. Each dollar invested in high-quality early childhood programs produces somewhere between $7 and $15 in returns over the life course through health, education, employment, and reduced criminal justice involvement. The Heckman curve is a standard reference in early childhood policy advocacy.
And the implementation challenge?
Way harder than the science. Early childhood investment produces returns 40 to 60 years later. Most political systems can't sustain attention for that long. The visible programs that work, high-quality preschool, comprehensive prenatal care, evidence-based home visiting, require sustained funding through political cycles that don't naturally align with the timescales of the returns. The Nordic countries have the most extensive early childhood investment infrastructure. Their population health outcomes reflect this investment with some lag.
And the module flags the limits of life course thinking too.
Yeah. Long follow-up is expensive. Mortality selection is a problem. The people who survive to be measured at age 80 are systematically different from those who don't. Recall bias affects retrospective life course measures. Asking 70-year-olds about their childhood experiences and the methodological work required to translate life course findings into causal claims is substantial. The field has historically been somewhat permissive about causal language for what are often correlational findings.
And the interpretive challenge around individual responsibility.
That's the one I keep coming back to. Findings that childhood adversity predicts adult disease can be misread as individual deterministic claims. You are doomed because of what happened to you as a child. The accurate reading is population level. Childhood adversity raises population level risk. And probabilistic. Most people with high ACE scores do not develop the predicted outcomes, and most people with serious chronic disease did not have particularly adverse childhoods. Communicating this nuance to non-technical audiences is hard. We'll come back to it.
Okay, section two, DOHAD.
Developmental origins of health and disease. The strongest single set of findings in life course epidemiology comes from the discovery that prenatal conditions program adult disease risk decades later. Founding observation came from David Barker, a British epidemiologist who noticed an unusual pattern in geographic mortality data.
Walk us through Barker.
Barker, 1938 to 2013. In the 80s, he noticed that areas of England with high infant mortality in the 1910s and 1920s, typically areas with substantial undernutrition in pregnant women, now had high adult cardiovascular mortality among the cohorts born in those years. The pattern was robust to controlling for adult socioeconomic conditions and adult risk factors. He hypothesized that fetal undernutrition produced permanent metabolic changes at what he called the thrifty phenotype that increased risk of cardiovascular and metabolic disease in adulthood. The hypothesis was published in The Lancet in 1986 and elaborated through papers and books over the following decades.
And the thrifty phenotype is mechanistically intuitive.
Yeah. A fetus exposed to undernutrition adapts to scarce energy by developing a metabolic phenotype optimized for low caloric availability, smaller body size, lower metabolic rate, greater fat storage efficiency, altered glucose-insulin dynamics. The adaptations are appropriate for the in utero environment and produce viable babies despite the constraints. But if the postnatal environment is one of caloric abundance, the mismatch between fetal programming and adult environment, then the same metabolic adaptations that supported in utero survival become risk factors for obesity, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease in adulthood.
And the hypothesis was initially controversial.
Several other groups failed to replicate aspects of the original findings. The mechanism, programming during a brief in utero exposure window producing decades later disease, seemed implausible to many biologically trained researchers. The hypothesis has been substantially confirmed by subsequent work. Prospective cohorts, animal models, natural experiments, most famously the Dutch hunger winter, and increasingly clear epigenetic mechanism work. Barker died in 2013. The field he founded is now called DOHAD and has its own journal, professional society, and substantial research infrastructure.
The Dutch hunger winter is one of the most painful natural experiments in the literature.
Between November 1944 and May 1945, The Nazi occupation of the Western Netherlands produced one of the most severe famines in modern European history. As retribution for Dutch resistance activities, the German military authority restricted food imports into the urban areas of the Western provinces, combined with an unusually cold winter and the disruption of agricultural production. The result was a famine in which daily caloric intake fell to approximately 400 to 800 kilocalories per day for several million people.
And it ended abruptly.
In May 1945, when Allied forces liberated the Western Netherlands and food deliveries resumed, the discrete, severe, time-limited nature of the famine, combined with the excellent demographic and medical records the Dutch maintained throughout, made it a uniquely informative natural experiment for DOHUT-D research. The cohort of children exposed to famine in utero and the comparison cohorts conceived just before or after has been studied prospectively since the 1970s.
And the findings?
Developed by research groups led by Lambert Lumé, Arye Stein, Tessa Roseboom, and others over four decades, adults who were exposed to famine in the first trimester of pregnancy have elevated rates of cardiovascular disease, obesity, type 2 diabetes, schizophrenia, depression, and breast cancer. The effects vary by trimester. First trimester exposure produces cardiovascular and metabolic effects. Late pregnancy exposure produces lower birth weight and somewhat different adult outcomes. And this is the striking part. Effects are detectable in the F2 generation, the grandchildren of famine-exposed women, suggesting transgenerational effects through epigenetic mechanisms.
And the mechanism work.
Epigenetic mark studies in famine-exposed individuals have identified persistent DNA methylation differences at specific genes, IGF2 and others, that may mediate the metabolic effects. The contemporary DOHAD research is increasingly focused on epigenetic mechanisms, DNA methylation, histone modification, non-coding RNA changes associated with various prenatal exposures, whether these mechanisms can be specifically targeted, epigenetic therapy in childhood to reverse adverse prenatal programming is one of the major open questions of the field.
And DOHAD extends beyond the famine cohorts.
The famine cohorts give the cleanest natural experiments, but represent extreme exposures. Broader DOHAD evidence extends to more common exposures. Maternal smoking during pregnancy associated with elevated cardiovascular and metabolic disease risk in offspring. Maternal obesity and gestational diabetes produce metabolic effects in offspring. Maternal stress and depression during pregnancy associated with offspring behavioral and mental health outcomes. Endocrine disrupting chemical exposure during pregnancy, BPA, phthalates, PFAS, linked to offspring outcomes, including obesity, diabetes, reproductive disorders.
And the framing extends beyond undernutrition.
Maternal overnutrition and obesity during pregnancy appear to produce some of the same metabolic effects in offspring as undernutrition. The thrifty phenotype framing extends to a broader mismatched programming framework. The field has expanded into a fetal programming framework that includes nutrition, stress, toxins, and other prenatal exposures.
And this is where the ethical communication challenge is really sharp.
PET findings are sometimes used to justify intensive monitoring of pregnant women's behavior. And the module reflection asks how to balance the legitimate science with the risk of blaming mothers for adult disease. The answer that the module lands on, and that I defend, is that the same evidence that justifies collective action, improving maternal nutritional security, addressing food deserts, reducing chronic stress, providing accessible prenatal care, does not necessarily justify individual action against pregnant women. DOHAD findings establish population-level relationships, often under extreme conditions like famine. They do not establish that a given woman's choices in pregnancy determined her child's adult disease.
And the policy translation that matters?
Upstream policy, paid maternity leave, maternal mental health services, prenatal care, food security, not individual surveillance and blame, maternal shaming based on DOHAD-style evidence is unfortunately common and is generally counterproductive. Produces compliance theater rather than behavior change, and generates stress that may itself have adverse fetal effects.
Okay, section 3, ACEs, childhood adversity.
If DOHAD established that prenatal environment matters, the ACE study established that early childhood adversity matters across an extraordinarily wide range of adult outcomes. The ACE framework has been one of the most influential developments in public health of the past quarter century, and it's been substantially critiqued in ways that any user should know.
The origin story is unusual.
It came from an obesity treatment program at Kaiser Permanente in San Diego in the late 1980s. Vincent Felitti, a physician running the program, observed that patients who lost substantial weight often subsequently dropped out of the program before reaching their goals. Routine interviews suggested that for many patients, weight gain was a coping response to early life trauma, particularly childhood sexual abuse.
And he partnered with Robert Anda at the CDC
to design a systematic investigation. They administered a 10-item questionnaire about childhood adversity to over 17,000 adult Kaiser members between 1995 and 1997. The questionnaire covered three categories: abuse, psychological, physical, sexual, neglect, physical, emotional, and household dysfunction, substance abuse in the household, mental illness in the household, parental separation or divorce, domestic violence against the mother, household criminal activity. Each yes or no item added one to a participant's ACE score, range 0 to 10.
And the findings published in 1998.
Striking, strong dose-response relationship between ACE count and a wide range of adult outcomes. Adults with ACE scores of 4 or more had approximately 4 times the odds of severe depression, 7 times the odds of alcoholism, 12 times the odds of attempted suicide, 2 to 4 times the odds of smoking, elevated risk for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, ischemic heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and other conditions. The relationship was monotonic. More ACEs predicted worse outcomes, and the dose response was steep.
And the study's been replicated hundreds of times.
Across different populations, different ACE measurement instruments, different outcome measures, the basic findings hold. The dose-response relationship between childhood adversity and adult health is one of the most robust observations in social epidemiology.
Walk us through the mechanism.
Several pathways, often operating simultaneously. Biological pathways. Chronic activation of stress response systems during sensitive developmental periods produces lasting alterations in immune function, cardiovascular regulation, metabolic health. Behavioral pathways, people with high ACE exposure are more likely to engage in health risk behaviors that are often coping responses to ongoing distress. Social pathways, childhood adversity disrupts educational trajectories, occupational opportunities, relationship stability, producing adult social positions associated with poorer health, and epigenetic pathways. Persistent changes in gene expression patterns following childhood adversity have been characterized in cortisol regulation genes, immune genes, and others.
And the critiques have been substantial.
The ACE score is a blunt instrument. It treats radically different experiences as equivalent. A parental divorce counts the same as repeated sexual abuse. It doesn't distinguish severity, chronicity, age of onset, or relational context. The 10 items omit categories of adversity, poverty, racism, community violence, housing instability, that are likely as important as the listed items. Several alternative ACE measures have been developed. The Philadelphia ACE Project added items for witnessing violence, racism, bullying, unsafe neighborhoods. The WHO ACE International Questionnaire, the Childhood Trauma Questionnaire, measures severity rather than presence-absence. None of these has fully displaced the original 10-item score because the original simplicity makes it tractable in large samples.
And the population versus individual issue?
This is the key one. ACE findings are population level. An adult with an ACE score of 6 has elevated population level risk for many conditions, but most adults with high ACE scores do not develop the predicted conditions. And most adults with serious chronic conditions did not have particularly high ACE scores. Treating an ACE score as an individual diagnosis or prognosis is a category error. The clinical use of ACE screening, increasingly common in some healthcare systems, has been criticized for producing labeling effects and for shifting attention from structural factors to individual histories.
And the protective factor side?
The original framework focused on adversity, but not on protective factors. Subsequent work has emphasized that protective childhood experiences, stable adult relationships, community connection, predictable routines, sense of safety, buffer against the effects of adversity. Counting positive childhood experiences, PCEs, alongside ACEs produces better prediction of adult outcomes than ACE counting alone. The contemporary framing increasingly emphasizes the developmental ecology of childhood, not just the absence of harm.
And the structural versus individual framing?
This connects to a theme we've hit throughout the course. Many of the experiences captured by ACEs, household dysfunction, parental substance use, parental mental illness, parental incarceration, are themselves consequences of structural conditions. Poverty, racism, criminalized substance use, inadequate mental health treatment. Addressing ACEs without addressing these structural conditions risks treating downstream symptoms while ignoring upstream causes.
And what's the response?
The most effective public health responses to ACEs are usually structural ones, poverty reduction, evidence-based home visiting like Nurse Family Partnership and Healthy Families America, paid family leave, addiction treatment as healthcare rather than as criminal justice. The contemporary policy uptake of ACEs research has been substantial. California implemented universal ACE screening in pediatric Medi-Cal in 2020, the first U.S. state to do so at scale. Several Canadian provinces have introduced trauma-informed practice frameworks across their health and social services systems.
And the upstream interventions have the best evidence.
Evidence-based home visiting programs reduce child maltreatment in randomized trials. Earned income tax credits and child benefits reduce child poverty in ways that improve childhood circumstances. Substance use treatment for parents reduces parental impairment as an ACE for children. Comprehensive paid parental leave reduces stressors during the early postnatal period. Each of these has substantial evidence of effectiveness. Collectively, they would substantially reduce ACE prevalence in the next generation if implemented at scale.
And in the Canadian Indigenous context, the ACE framing is especially fraught.
Residential schools, the 60s scoop, and ongoing child welfare overrepresentation are mass-scale ACE production systems. The relationship between ACE research and the broader Indigenous health agenda is a particularly active area of contemporary work. The structural reading is the right one. Adverse childhood experiences for Indigenous children weren't isolated household-level events. They were the product of explicit federal policy.
And on the clinical side, what should an ACE score actually tell a clinician?
The module's reflection answer is the right framing. The score tells a clinician this person has substantially elevated population level risk for a range of conditions, and that screening for those conditions might be warranted earlier than usual. It tells the clinician this person may have experienced things that affect how they engage with the healthcare system. Mistrust, dissociation under stress, difficulty with disclosure. It does not tell them whether this specific patient will have those outcomes. Population risk is not individual prophecy. Good trauma-informed care uses the score as a flag, not a diagnosis.
Okay, section 4, healthy aging and the CLSA.
If most of life course epidemiology has focused on early life, the recent expansion of older adult research is one of the field's most active frontiers, and Canada is a global leader in it through the Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging.
Start with the conceptual framing, the Rowe-Kahn Successful Aging Model.
In 1987, John Rowe and Robert Kahn published a paper in Science distinguishing usual from successful aging. They argued the public health and clinical research literature had conflated normal aging, age-related declines, with usual aging. The average trajectory, which includes substantial preventable decline, and that some older adults achieve successful aging that combine low risk of disease and disability, high cognitive and physical function, and active engagement in life. The framework launched the MacArthur studies of successful aging.
And the framework had useful effects, but faced critique.
Generated useful research questions. What protects function? What risk factors are modifiable in old age? What determines successful aging? But the successful aging construct was criticized as aspirational, ableist, and culturally narrow. It implied that aging with disability or chronic disease was unsuccessful, which was both empirically and ethically problematic. The framework also tended to attribute successful aging to individual characteristics, behaviors, attitudes, choices, rather than structural conditions like income, social position, access to healthcare.
And then the WHO reframed it.
2015, World Report on Aging and Health, defined healthy aging as the process of developing and maintaining the functional ability that enables well-being in older age, emphasizes function rather than disease absence, more inclusive of people aging with disability, treats aging as a multidimensional process that interacts with environmental conditions to produce the actual capacities and experiences of older adults, adopted by the WHO, increasingly the reference framework for international aging policy, the WHO 2021 to 2030. Decade of Healthy Aging is the flagship initiative.
And the CLSA, we mentioned it last lesson, but let's go deeper.
Launched 2010 under the scientific leadership of Parminder Reyna at McMaster, Christina Wolfson at McGill, Susan Kirkland at Dalhousie and others, one of the largest and most comprehensive aging cohorts in the world, recruited 51,338 Canadians aged 45 to 85 between 2010 and 2015. Two recruitment strategies, a tracking cohort of 21,241 participants assessed by telephone, and a comprehensive cohort of 30,097 assessed in person at 11 data collection sites across Canada with physical measurements and biospecimens. Both followed every 3 years.
and the breadth of data.
Extraordinary. Demographics, socioeconomic position, social participation, health behaviors, physical and mental health, healthcare use, cognitive function, biomarkers from blood, urine, hair, and with consent, linkage to administrative health data. The comprehensive cohort also has detailed physical measurements, anthropometry, blood pressure, lung function, hand grip strength, bone density, balance, cognitive testing. The breadth means CLSA can address questions that no single specialized cohort could.
And the publication record?
More than 600 peer-reviewed publications as of 2026. Topics from sleep and cognition to social isolation, frailty, multimorbidity, retirement, healthcare use. The cohort provided substantial COVID-era evidence on aging populations, vaccine response, social isolation effects, acceleration of cognitive decline, and the CLSA data and sample repository is available to qualified researchers through a controlled access portal, one of Canada's most used population health research resources.
And the limits?
Sample somewhat skewed toward higher SES, higher educated urban Canadians, smaller representation from Indigenous communities, rural and remote communities, non-white populations. Recruitment of these populations has been a stated priority in subsequent waves, but remains imperfect. The age range of 45 to 85 at baseline means the cohort doesn't capture the very old population, 90 plus or younger adults.
Then the blue zones, which the module is critical of.
The blue zones framing claims that five specific regions of the world, Sardinia, Italy, Okinawa, Japan, Nicoya Peninsula, Costa Rica, Ikaria, Greece, Loma Linda, California, have unusual concentrations of centenarians and exceptional longevity. The framing has been popularized into a substantial commercial wellness brand by Dan Bettner and collaborators. The underlying research has been criticized on multiple grounds that any public health student should know.
Walk us through.
Selection effects. The five blue zones were selected through a process that was not fully systematic. Other regions with similar demographic profiles were not consistently considered. The selection process appears to have favored regions where the popular narrative could be developed. And second, and this is the more damaging critique, centenarian counts. Subsequent analysis by the Australian demographer Saul Justin Newman has shown that several of the blue zone centenarian counts are likely artifacts of pension fraud, poor vital records, and identity confusion. The deceased's identity continuing to receive pension benefits, wrong birth date on records. When Newman applied stricter demographic verification, the centenarian density of several blue zones falls substantially.
So the takeaway on blue zones?
Some of the lifestyle observations from these regions are likely valid in general terms. Plant-rich diets, social connection, physical activity throughout the life course, sense of purpose. These align with broader evidence, but the specific blue zones framing carries empirical baggage that's worth being aware of. And the commercial wellness adaptation of blue zones tends to elide the political and economic conditions that produce the lifestyle patterns, suggesting they're individually achievable when they're better understood as products of specific cultural and structural conditions.
And the contemporary policy frontier on aging.
Canada's aging population is the major demographic story of the next 30 years. The proportion of Canadians over 65 is projected to reach approximately 25% by 2050. The implications for healthcare, long-term care, pensions, workforce, and intergenerational equity are substantial. CLSA and related research is producing evidence on what supports healthy aging, physical activity, social connection, cognitive engagement, prevention of frailty, management of multimorbidity, age-friendly environments. The WHO's age-friendly cities framework is being implemented in many Canadian municipalities.
And the long-term care reform agenda?
Hugely consequential. COVID-19 exposed substantial weaknesses in Canadian long-term care, particularly in for-profit facilities, which had higher mortality during the pandemic than public or nonprofit facilities. Long-term care reform, staffing ratios, wages, training, infection control, family access policies has become a major policy area. The Federal Safe Long-Term Care Act introduced in 2024 is intended to set national standards. Whether it will succeed in producing systemic change is one of the open questions of the late 2020s.
Let me try to pull this together. Eight quick takeaways.
Go.
First, life course epidemiology treats current health as the cumulative result of exposures, opportunities, and choices reaching back to and before birth. Three models. Cumulative, sensitive period, trajectory, usually combined. The intellectual move is treating time as a variable, not as a fixed background.
Second, The British birth cohorts from 1946 onward are the foundational longitudinal data sets in life course epidemiology. Canada doesn't yet have a comparable national birth cohort. Provincial work and the CLSA fill in pieces, but the gap is real.
Third, the Heckman curve, extraordinary returns to early childhood investment, provides the economic case for life course informed public health spending. The implementation challenge is that returns come 40 to 60 years later, beyond the time horizon of most political systems.
Fourth, DOHAD, Developmental Origins of Health and Disease, establishes that prenatal conditions program adult disease risk decades later. The Barker hypothesis, the Dutch hunger winter natural experiment, and increasingly clear epigenetic mechanism work provide the evidence. The thrifty phenotype framework explains how programming for in utero scarcity becomes maladaptive in environments of abundance.
Fifth, Doherty findings justify upstream collective policy on maternal nutrition, mental health, and prenatal care. They do not justify individual surveillance and shaming of pregnant women. The distinction between population science and individual prescription matters here as much as anywhere in public health.
Sixth, the AC study established a robust dose-response relationship between childhood adversity and adult health across a wide range of outcomes. Mechanisms include biological, behavioral, social, and epigenetic pathways. The 10-item ACE score is a blunt instrument with substantial limits, including missing structural adversities like poverty and racism. Alternative measures address some of those gaps.
Seventh, the most effective public health responses to ACEs are upstream and structural. Poverty reduction, paid family leave, evidence-based home visiting, addiction treatment as healthcare. Counting positive childhood experiences alongside ACEs improves prediction and shifts framing from deficit to developmental ecology.
And eighth, healthy aging research, including the Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging, has shifted the framing from successful aging, aspirational, ableist, to functional ability and environmental fit. The Blue Zone's popular framing carries empirical baggage that's worth knowing. And the policy frontier on aging, long-term care reform, age-friendly environments, intergenerational equity is among the most consequential ongoing public health stories of the next decade.
And the capstone milestone this week, students extend their topic across the life course.
Map out when in the life course your topic emerges, peaks, and resolves if it does. Identify any prenatal or childhood origins. Identify any aging-related dimensions. What does the life course framework reveal that a snapshot doesn't? That's week six.
And this is the halfway mark of the course. Six lessons down, six to go.
We've now covered concepts, the rise of public health, infectious disease, the lifestyle factors, sexual and reproductive health, and the life course. Next, we move into genetics and genomics, then health behaviors and mental health, then environmental health, then occupational and worker safety, then the social, economic, and political determinants. And we end with disability, diversity, and integrating the foundations.
Next lesson is genetics, genomics, and health.
Read the module, bring questions. We'll see you there.
Thanks for listening. See you in lesson seven.
Take care of yourselves. See you in class.